Hey everybody, new Slackademic single out, and this one's actually a ska song.
Your brown eyes are black holes, they drain the blue from the sky. The orange light is...
The second single from our album Pass Fail is out, Amplify, and it is a love song. Ooh. You can check it out on all the streaming platforms, but if you really want to support the band, head to our Bandcamp page and pre-order the record. You can own it in whatever digital format you want. It's actually cheaper now before the record comes out. TheSlackademics.bandcamp.com.
So take my hand and plant your feet. One bounding leap, we will see our souls meet. To amplify.
Like to laugh, geek out on music, and learn all about that band or artist who had that one song back in the day but then seemed to fall off the face of the earth? If so, you need to subscribe to One Hit Thunder. Together with an array of interesting and hilarious guests, we do a weekly dive into one-hit wonders like Eiffel 65's Blue, Krayshawn's Gucci Gucci, EMF's Unbelievable, Delamitri's Roll to Me, Los Del Rio's Macarena, Musical Youth's Pass the Dutchie, and even Patrick Swayze's She's Like the Wind. So are you subscribed to One Hit Thunder or what? As Desiree would say, you gotta be. And as K7 would encourage, you gotta come baby come and join in on the fun of the One Hit Thunder podcast.
And I'm also realizing that you two know way more about music than me because you're just naming tracks. And I'm like, oh yeah, yeah, you too. Yeah. Remember when they took over my iPhone and I was mad? Like...
Well, one of us has been trained and the other one went to grad school to study music.
I don't know which one you categorized me in of those two examples, Mark, because I think that I've
Did
just...
you go to grad school for music?
No, I didn't.
Then you're the trained one.
Hey, I'm Nicole.
And I'm Mark.
And this is Nevermind the Music. It's a sidetrack day and we have a guest.
Aren't you supposed to say, who are we talking about?
Oh, wait. Every time.
What are we talking to?
Who are we talking to today, Mark?
We are talking to Matt Kelly.
Hey.
From the Geekscape Network and a lot of podcasts. So let me see how many I can do off the top of my head. Okay. One Hit Thunder.
Mm-hmm.
Christmas 365.
Yep.
Christian Cringe.
Mm-hmm.
Weird Algorithm.
Mm-hmm.
Horror Movie Night.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe is that where I stop right now? Help me out. So welcome, Matt Kelly. Welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, those are the ones I would claim. I also produce YAOK, and I occasionally appear on that. But that is not, that's not one of my main ones.
So we talked about Christmas 365 on our podcast. It came up in probably a Christmas episode that we were doing. And I had so many questions. I was really just astounded that there was that much Christmas content to cover. But Mark was like, oh, there's so much. So now that you're here, can you just tell us what that is? I was so curious.
So one of my favorite podcasts ever was this podcast called The Gilmore Guys, where it was two guys reviewing every episode of Gilmore Girls. And it like blew up to the level that they were like playing sold out concert venues, like doing their podcast.
Nice.
And what I thought was so charming about the podcast was that it was a very explicit podcast about a very wholesome thing. And I was like, what other like overwhelmingly wholesome thing could I do an R-rated podcast about? And then I had a friend who I knew loved Christmas as much as I did. And he was going through a divorce at the time. And like, to me, I'm like, oh, I want to help someone through trauma. And one of the ways I can do that is like, come up with an excuse for us to do an activity together on a weekly basis to have interaction. So I called him and was like, hey, would you want to do a podcast about Christmas? And he was like, abso-fucking-lutely. And like, we sat down. But there, I mean, Netflix probably produces about 10 new Christmas movies every year. Hallmark pumps them out. There's like 8 Christmas albums a year. So like what we do with the show is... I'll start with October. In October, we dedicate it just to Christmas horror stuff. So we watch like a Tales from the Crypt Christmas episode, and we'll watch like Silent Night, Deadly Night, and any of those movies. November and December is when we do like what we call our heavy hitters, the ones that are like our childhood favorites that meant the world to us and that like make us think of Christmas. And then January to March, we record those episodes through the month of December, and it's us reviewing every new piece of Christmas content that dropped in the previous year.
Wow.
So that we get like a 3-month break from talking about Christmas from January to March. And then starting in March, it's kind of like, oh, a new season of Abbott Elementary is launching. Let's watch one of the old Christmas episodes to like tie in to that season. Or like we did that with The Bear. We watched the Forks episode of The Bear when the new season was coming out. Like we just kind of try to pay attention to what's happening in pop culture and tie it into that. We want it to not be obnoxiously Christmassy in July because that sucks for us too. So if the idea of an all year round Christmas podcast sounds like absolute hell to you, still check it out. I think you'll have fun with it.
This podcast comes out in a couple days on Tuesday, January 6th, which happens to be the literal 12th day of Christmas, the Epiphany. So if you hear this, you've still got time for it to be seasonally appropriate. Now, tomorrow, it will be seasonally inappropriate, which still might be a great idea, but you've still got time later today to listen to on-topic Christmas content.
Ugh, I'm over Christmas.
Do you know, if you take that song for face value, and every time that they start a new line, you assume that they are getting now a second partridge in a pear tree, or they're getting...
So 12 partridges, not just one.
Yeah. Do you know how many gifts you receive?
It's got to be a few hundred, right?
364, because the point of that song is that Christmas can happen all year, baby!
Here we are.
It's like they knew. It's like they knew.
All right, but I'm not here to talk about my Christmas podcast.
So, Matt, what are we here for? So, Matt, I will say you deserve accolades because you actually are a professional podcaster in the sense that the rest of us have to go to work. You are currently at work.
I'm currently at work. It's the worst paying job that I've loved the most.
Unfortunately, as a musician, I can tell you that I can empathize with that for sure. But we are here to talk about music, among other things, because we invited Matt to come on our podcast because there's so many things you can talk about, from Christmas to music to horror movies. But you had a very specific thing you wanted to bring to us and rant about.
I've talked about this on the One Hit Thunder podcast probably more than any other podcast, but I have this theory. It's not even a theory. My personal favorite time period for music is like 1995 to 1997. As a kid who grew up listening to alternative radio at that time, I think that there was this magical thing that happened. And unfortunately, the magical thing begins with Kurt Cobain's death. But Kurt Cobain dies in 1994. And the record companies were not ready to let go of what Nirvana was, this lightning in a bottle thing. And we just get these 3 years of the strangest, like, shot in the dark bands getting signed and having minor hits on alternative radio. And like, that was, to me, is just the most incredible time to ever be listening to music. Because like, for most of music history, pop music is a very specific definitive sound for every single decade. 80s pop has a very specific sound. 70s pop has a very distinct sound. 90s pop also has a very distinct sound. You can do that with rock music too. There is a 70s rock sound. There is what the rock music of the 80s sounded like. When Nirvana and Pearl Jam and all of these Seattle bands started blowing up, it kind of blurred these lines, because you're looking at, you know, the big four of the Seattle sound are Pearl Jam, Nirvana, Alice in Chains, and Soundgarden. And I would argue that none of those four bands sound like each other at all, but we're still grouped into this singular genre that was grunge, right? Are we all in agreement in that?
I agree with that for sure. And you think if you compare Pearl Jam and Soundgarden, I do lump them together, but you're right, they are very different.
And I would say they're the two that are the closest in a sound. Like, Alice in Chains is borderline a heavy metal band.
Sure. Sludge metal.
Nirvana is borderline a punk band.
So much of what you're saying is relating to previous guests we've had and stuff. A lot of this relates to our conversations about Blondie and about punk and hope punk and all that from a few months ago, where a lot of it is place and time, right? Yeah. So, like, this is why when you hear arguably a sound-alike band, the first Stone Temple Pilots record, look, I'm a San Diegan. I like Stone Temple Pilots. And that first record sounds a lot like Pearl Jam, but by virtue of it being from San Diego and not from Seattle, it is sort of necessarily post-grunge and not grunge, right? Yes. Because being baked into the location, even though Soundgarden's most proggy kind of 5'8 changing into 5'4 time signature crazy stuff on one of their albums has nothing to do with Smells Like Teen Spirit. It still has more to do with it than Sex Type Thing by Stone Temple Pilots does, just because they were going to play at the same shows.
You also get something similar with the Smashing Pumpkins too, where the Smashing Pumpkins is very easy to lump into that same style, but because they weren't Seattle proper, they kind of got put in a sort of separate category, right? But what happens is all of a sudden Kurt Cobain, who's like the figurehead of all of this to the mainstream media, is gone. And like, it's a combination of they've already signed a bunch of these bands that Kurt Cobain likes, like the Gits and Daniel Johnston. like these weird avant-garde artists are getting major record label deals that they have almost no business having.
People that people know because he wore a t-shirt with the band name at one of his shows.
100%.
Or at a photo shoot or Unplugged or whatever.
Yeah, so that starts to happen. But they're like, all right, well, we signed these bands that Kurt liked, so we got to push these guys. And then simultaneously, they're trying to find the next Nirvana. The example I always use is, and then they stumble onto a band like Butthole Surfers and are like, well, let's give them a shot.
Oh, my God. I'll pipe in Pepper or something like that. And then, because imagine, I don't know exactly if I've got the years right, but imagine like alternative rock radio would have Pepper by Butthole Surfers.
They were all in love with dying. They were drinking from a fountain that was pouring like an avalanche coming down the mountain.
I don't mind the sun sometimes, the images it shows. I can taste you on my lips and smell you in my clothes.
And then Fastball the Way would be the next song.
Where were they going without ever knowing the way? Anyone could see the road that they walk on is paved in gold. And it's always summer, they'll never get cold.
And my doofusy teenage self did not think that was weird, when it's very weird.
It's very, very weird.
And compared to a lot of eras. I think this comes back to our conversation with David on generational music theorem and all that stuff, how when you're in the era, things feel very separate, but later they feel more united, right? In the sense that, like, I can listen to Devo and Michael McDonald and not feel weird about it, but probably in 1978, maybe I couldn't have. It would have felt too separate.
Yeah.
These disparate worlds on alternative radio felt somehow unified, even though sonically they're way more different even than we were talking about the grunge bands being different from one another.
And I think part of that is because alternative rock, just based on its name alone, it is the alternative to the other rock station music. It's a little bit more aggressive. It's that 120 minutes on MTV style of music. That's why, as crazy as it is to think about, listen to, say, Bullet the Blue Sky by U2 on the Joshua Tree.
Turn the key and slowly unlock the door. The man breathes into his saxophone. And through the walls, you hear the city groan. Outside, it's America. Outside, it's America.
Not a band that I think anyone would put into an alternative grunge group, right? But they would get played on the alternative radio stations all the time. And you listen to like Bullet the Blue Sky, that is a grunge song. The guitar effects, the anger in it, the way that Bono will just like go on a mini rant in the middle of the song before it breaks into like chaos. Like, it is a grunge song from 1987, similar to like how REM, who is so jangle pop, was like so wrapped up into that alternative rock scene at the same time.
But you don't hear those guys as alternative, because like, I think we can't equate, like, grunge is one type of alternative,
one
rock,
type of
right?
Alternative. Yeah.
You could blow up really far and call punk and stuff like that alternative music too, but really, like, alternative rock could, like, okay, you cited REM and U2, which existed first in the 80s, right?
Yes.
And those feel more like alternative rock as an outgrowth of post-punk, which is another thing we talked about on the Hope Punk episode. You know, listen to early U2 and it's sort of post-punky, but not grungy, right?
No.
Kind of a different thing. If you think of like Jesus and Mary Chain, like that stuff's alternative without being grunge. It predates grunge. Or gosh, Violent Femmes.
Violent Femmes,
that's
is a
an
good
alternative rock
too.
Band. But
I think we're talking about college rock. Like, we're talking about college radio, right?
Right.
That's what it would have been called at the time, is the college
sure.
radio bands.
Yeah.
But what I think is interesting, I think this is why I go to U2 specifically, is that U2 throughout the 80s into the early 90s is so clearly like part of the inspiration of what alternative rock becomes. But then by the time alternative rock is having its time in the sun, it's almost like U2 shifts to just being a generic radio rock band at that exact same time.
You're talking like Mysterious Ways, like
yeah.
Octoon Baby era.
Yeah. Like
that's really interesting.
Like, because think about that. Like, as all of this is happening, they put out Octoon Baby. They put out, what's the zoo one?
Not Zootopia.
No, not that's
Zooropa?
What I keep almost saying. I can't remember what
is
the
it Zooropa?
But then they put out Pop, which is like widely considered one of the worst albums they've ever released. And I think part of it is because it's such generic radio music from a band that was so important to alternative music. And I think that there's some great songs on Pop. Staring at the Sun was like a minor hit off of that I think is like one of the best sure. U2 songs. But
that feels like an alternative rock song.
It does.
I'm not the only one staring at the sun, afraid of what you find. If you took a look inside, am I just different girl?
Not the rest of that album. When you get to like When God Would Send His Angels and Discotheque, you're like, okay, this is right. Not quite right.
Nicole, do you know any of this music? You're chuckling along, but like, have we lost
I'm
you?
I'm chuckling along. I'm realizing a lot here. I'm realizing I'm much, much, much younger than you guys because I wasn't like listening to music at this time. I was like in diapers.
We've established you are measurably older than me, right? By a couple months.
Well, also like during this period that you're discussing, this like late 90s, mid to late 90s, I was for sure heavy into Eric Clapton, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, like Bob Dylan. Like I was...
You were looking backward already.
Yeah, I was working backwards. I was like pretending to be a hippie, like going to Grateful Dead cover bands and stuff like that. Like that was my vibe. So I'm realizing that as you're talking. And I'm also realizing that you two know way more about music than me because you're just naming tracks. And I'm like, oh, yeah, you too. Yeah. Remember when they took over my iPhone and I was mad? Like,
well, one of us has been trained and the other one went to grad school to study music.
I don't know which one you categorized me in of those two examples, Mark, because I think that I've
Did
just...
you go to grad school for music?
No, I didn't.
Then you're the trained one.
Questions, like more theoretical questions about this label of alternative music. So we're in this time period, we're grouping alternative music really as something that doesn't fit into any other established genre, something that's literally an alternative to what we've been fed already
yes.
by the music industry. So noted. When, in your perception, does alternative music get played so much that it flips over to pop or flips over to mainstream or flips over to something else? And you're talking about it a little bit with U2,
yeah,
right? How they were coded as maybe alternative, but then later on they transitioned to more mainstream, literally having an album called Pop,
yeah.
which admittedly I've never heard, but it sounds awful, so
great.
I'm not going to listen to it. Sorry, U2. Like, I'm wondering, when do we switch?
I think about 97, 98.
Like if Nirvana was still alive, yeah.
Well, that's... So Chuck Klosterman, one of my favorite people to ever write about music, has this book. I think it's the book Eating the Dinosaur. He has this chapter where he proposes, what if Kurt Cobain never dies, but Rivers Cuomo dies after Pinkerton comes out? Like, does that change the way we talk about both of those bands? Do we now look at Weezer as this unbelievable band that had so much potential and how we were robbed of all of the greatness that they would have because they only got two albums? But then, like, Kurt Cobain, you mentioned Eric Clapton. He's like, Kurt Cobain, we literally could see having this kind of pseudo-lame Eric Clapton doing a lounge version of Linoleum on MTV Unplugged in his 50s moment.
Like, and we're, like, seeing them in concert being like, play Nevermind.
So, Nevermind the music lore, everybody. I have to chime in. On one of our mailbag episodes, we were dragged through the coals by a listener about our comments, inflammatory comments, really, about Weezer. Yes. That person who wrote in was Matthew Kelly, who we are talking to right this second.
Hey.
So to your point, I mean, that's a really well-made quotation of Klosterman that, yeah, if Rivers had died after Pinkerton, that would have been a legendary two-album run, right? And he specifically would have been viewed as more of a genius and not sort of like grown in to be kind of, you know, some people, certain podcasts might hassle them about their later music, but also like you can imagine like Matt Sharp. I think Matt Sharp was still in the band during Pinkerton, right?
Yeah.
Going off and creating the Rentals, and it would have like had this. I know he already had started it, but
the Rentals would have been the Foo Fighters.
Right.
Yeah. So like we would have been looking at one of the other guys in Weezer and been like, well, you know, that guy's really made quite a career.
Yeah.
instead of, you know, Matt Sharp has like post-rock bands I've heard and stuff and he solo stuff, but like the other guys of Weezer have, you know, orbited Weezer essentially.
Mm.
That's really interesting. To the sort of question of what happens when alternative stops to be alternative. I'm not the psychologist in this trio on this call, but that tension was troubling to some of those musicians.
I mean, that started, I would say that was a worry in 1992. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like as early as it happened, it was like this organic underground thing. You know, all of them hated the label grunge. You can find interviews from like 1992. I know that there's one where Kurt Cobain's like, they're fucking selling flannel for $500 at the Gap now because it's grunge wear. Like, he's like, I bought this for a dollar at the Goodwill. Like, it was this, like, commercialization of what was a very genuine underground scene that all of them disliked. And I think, you know, you started getting issues even as early as 94. I loved this band and I still love this band, but the hatred that would come out towards a band like Bush for being like poser grunge, you know, like these pretty boys doing grunge music now. And it's like, doesn't matter that 16 Stone album is fucking incredible.
That's a good song. Yeah. I think Kurt was aware of that and not comfortable with it.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say that's what led to his death, but
I think it was part of it.
It's in there, you know, this idea that this has been commodified and that's really not what he wanted. And then 5 years later, you say 1992, right? But like by the time we get to like...
I would say 97 is the real breaking point.
Mm.
Right. By the time we get to Eve 6 and Third Eye Blind and
Matchbox
The Flies
20.
And these bands that are like alternative bands that really are just, that's the new pop rock.
Yes.
And I thought of those bands as alternative bands when I was like, you know, high schooler or whatever, but they were the new pop rock. And then that term became modern rock. And so we had to create a new category that already existed, but amplify the category of indie, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because indie, like think early 2000s, those were essentially functionally equivalent bands to alternative bands a decade earlier, but we couldn't say alternative anymore because alternative was topping the charts at that point, at least sometimes.
Right. There's this very interesting thing that always happens. I've noticed as you look back into the past where it's like, the battle of being true to your roots indie rock while also being successful and on movie soundtracks has just been like this eternal battle, because it's like looking at, I remember my senior year of high school, 2004, all we listened to was the new album from Modest Mouse, and like that was on a major record label It was weird as shit, but that was still being labeled indie, even though it was very much a massive album on a major record label. Like even the term indie that should have just always been a band on an independent record label then gets co-opted to be the describer of a certain like out there sound.
And we even see that when you think of when Paramore was first signed, that we talked about this on a previous episode too, that the label made a pseudo label that no one heard of to promote Paramore under, so no one would know that it was RCA or whatever it was.
I think they could
be branded as like an indie band or a lesser known band.
I don't want to be speaking out of turn here. I think they had signed them to do Fueled by Ramen Records, which was like a somewhat known indie, like emo record label. And the only reason I say that is because I'm, you know, I do One Hit Thunder with Chris Fafayos of the band Punchline. And I know that he was sent, when his band was on Fueled by Ramen, they were sent to Japan with Paramore to be their opener. Like, hey, we're breaking this new band. And then it was only when I was listening to that episode, I'm like, oh, this band was always destined to be bigger than Punchline.
But Fueled by Ramen at that time, because Fueled by Ramen was a pure indie label, right? But were they owned by Atlantic yet? Was it still owned by the drummer from Less Than Jake?
By the drummer from Less Than Jake, but I want to say that the Paramore thing happened right after Fall Out Boy blew them up into the stratosphere, right?
And that makes sense, because that first Paramore record's like what? Probably like 2008 or something like that.
I want to say it's something like that, maybe 2004, 2005.
Oh, really?
Like the All Falls Apart album, I think, came out around the same time as the Fall Out Boy one. But
yeah, all we know is Falling 2005. Okay, 2005. Yeah. So
I think Fall Out Boy's album was 2004. So it makes sense, right? That this Fall Out Boy song, out of nowhere, this Sugar We're Going Down song becomes like the biggest song to ever hit the radio. And this small indie label that has them signed is now taking all these deals from major record labels. Of course, their next, like, Fall Out Boy type band, they're going to want to say, how about you guys put their first record out so that they get the street cred, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah,
totally.
So it's clever marketing, even for like an alternative indie band that you want it to be under the radar. You want it to be kind of like the out group of music that only certain people know about. It is all designed and packaged in a way to get us to buy into that idea and that like romantic idea that you're the first people that found this band and you know more than other people. And I think that's a part of how we listen to music. Don't you guys?
I still, you know, I'm sitting here and I'm surrounded by CDs. And I just leaned down and pulled up a stack of them from the ground. But like some of my nostalgia of first loving music is like sitting next to the CD player in my bedroom with the booklet open, reading the lyrics, combing through who they thanked to write down bands that I wanted to find their albums at the mall the next week, like just like really dissecting it like a science and treating the thank yous as like this algorithm for new music for me to discover. Because if Green Day thinks this band is cool, then they must be really good and I gotta go check out their stuff next.
And that's how this all started, right? This whole idea of Nirvana and alternative music, that Kurt Cobain was wearing these t-shirts of bands that no one really knew about.
Melvins or whatever.
And some people knew about and promoted it up to like the stratosphere. And I'm going back to this idea of, you know, this Weezer Nirvana, like what if, right? What if Weezer burned out, right?
I mean, you can play this what if with anything. What if Chris Farley didn't die? Would he have Kevin James's career? Right. Like who's to say?
Like, but the idea that I'm sticking with is the Foo Fighter piece.
Yeah.
Because if Nirvana had a longer career, there would be no Foo Fighters. And I know that Nirvana is influential, but I think, hot take, the Foo Fighters is... I'm stumbling because I know you're going to come at me.
You can say it out loud, Nicole.
I think they're better.
Well...
Oh, Matt's face.
No, but I don't disagree. Like, I think that there are better musicians in the Foo Fighters. I think that they are better at writing what is good rock music. I don't think the Foo Fighters have ever truly put out a awful album, but I think that the Foo Fighters make the complete opposite type of music that Nirvana was trying to make.
Fair. Yeah, like, no, I see that.
Like, it's hard to compare the two. The story that I've heard, and I hope that it's true, is, you know, David Grohl was working on Foo Fighters.
You and your David, famous for full naming everybody. David Grohl.
He's David Grohl. I treat everyone with respect around here, Marcus.
Mark Colomu.
So Dave Grohl was doing the Foo Fighters self-titled album completely by himself, playing all the instruments. And this was like a thing that he was doing as a side project while he was the drummer in Nirvana. And the first song that he'd completed is on the debut album. It's called Alone and Easy Target. And he apparently played that song for Kurt. And he's talked about, like, he just walked, he was talking to Kurt, and he's like, I want you to listen to this song that I wrote. And he plays the song, and he said, like, Kurt's, like, laying in a bathtub, and he, like, puts on the headphones, and he listens to the entire song. He's like, he's in the tub, he's smoking a cigarette. He finishes the song, he takes off the headphones, and he just holds my face and kisses me and says, I'm so glad I don't have to be the only songwriter in this band anymore. Oh, and then Dave said, oh, no, that's for a different... Kurt thought that he was like, hey, here's a song I wrote for Nirvana.
Oh, that's like really sad, though. Yeah. No, poor Kurt Cobain.
That song is quite grungy, though, right? Like, it's not Big Me, which is more jangle pop, or For All the Cows, whatever that is. Like, Alone and Easy Target, I'll pipe in an example. That would be a good Nirvana song, even sung by Dave Grohl. It would be cool. It's punky in that way, right? Can we back up almost to the source of this conversation? One of the things that Matt and I were offline going back and forth when we were coming up with what we should talk about was the sort of record label feeding frenzy that happened. Because it's not just that, like, there's a way we get to Butthole Surfers and then Bare Naked Ladies immediately following it on the radio.
Yeah.
We get there because of what the record labels are doing. And I think it's such a weird moment because we end up, I think, maybe one of you knows about this a little bit, a lot of one-hit wonders because of that. Because you've got, we're going to sign this band, whether it's a new band that hasn't proved themselves or whatever, or it's like, well, let's put Modest Mouse on a record label, even though they've been on an indie. We'll put them on a major. Flaming Lips or whatever, these bands that were indie that then joined majors. And then a lot of those bands would get one try, right? And I don't know if it's just they weren't getting development deals, you know, where like they would essentially have time and money to grow, or if it was a kind of throw everything at the wall and see what sticks immediately and abandon ship. I don't know. One hit wonder guru, what do you got? How'd that work?
A lot of them, like, and we've heard this story for so many one hit wonders, especially when we're talking about alternative one hit wonders, where it's like these bands get signed in 95, they get one single out there. And like, I think what people don't understand is what we consider a hit song and what a record label considers a hit song, they are dramatically different things. So like the example I always like to give is Nirvana. Like, people will sit there and think about Nirvana and be like, Nirvana was this huge band. If you look at the Billboard Hot 100, they like had maybe three songs that ever were so big that they crossed off of alternative rock into the Hot 100. And I think it was like Smells Like Teen Spirit, Lithium, maybe. And then I think the third one is after Kurt died, the You Know You're Right song. Like,
all right, so I got it. I got it. Smells Like Teen Spirit is the highest charting one, 91, six. It reached number six. Come As You Are, same record, same year, reached 32. Oh, no, that actually reached that in 92. Lithium hit 64. And then, yeah, a few years later, You Know You're Right is 45. So they only cracked the top 40 technically twice and the top 100 four times.
Yes. Yeah. That's not huge numbers by a record company that maybe, obviously they're not expecting it to be like Britney and Backstreet Boys numbers, but like, look at like, you had the Mariah Carey, look at how many number one hits Mariah Carey had across the 90s.
So many.
That's
like,
a
wild
success. Like, that's to the record label is like, this band is huge. So, like, when you have a band like Local H that's out there with, like, this minor hit that people don't even know the name of, they just remember it because it has a weird word that they've never used in their life in it. You know the song I'm talking about, right, Mark?
You mean copacetic?
And you just don't get it. Keep it copacetic and you learn to accept it. You know you're so pathetic and you just...
Copacetic, yes.
Like, so to me, so this goes back a long time. I think when we recorded the episode about Neon Trees, Nicole and I had said they were two-hit wonders. And there was some back... I was hoping you would know more. Is that Local H? Are they a one-hit wonder? Because I think High Five and MF... to my 14-year-old self, felt like a hit.
And it is. Even though you check the charts, that thing came nowhere near the charts. Like,
I mean, even Flaming Lips, you think, if you look at their hits, like Vaseline, probably.
Yeah, I don't even think Do You Realize or Yoshina did the numbers that I know them for. You know what I mean? Like, that's...
Right. Like, they're a great band. They're like a popular band. But as far as like critical acclaim or the Billboard 100, like they probably didn't. Well,
but I think what hurt a lot of these 94, 96 bands was that it wasn't just that the record label was losing faith in them. I think the record label was losing faith in the entire alternative music and grunge thing. And that's why, while they're pushing the Butthole Surfers, they're also pushing the Bare Naked Ladies and Fastball and Matchbox 20 that has way more of a top 40 crossover appeal.
Vibe. Yeah.
It's interesting because there's also like tiny life cycles within this, right? So within all of this is the shorter lifespan of like ska punk, for example, or even shorter than that, like neo swing, right? You have the 18 months.
Mark,
where...
I was thinking about you just the other day with neo swing because you obviously you came on One Hit Thunder to talk about Squirrel Nut Zippers. And it dawned on me that we forgot something in that episode that is huge.
We got to air it all now.
We were talking about the origins of the swing revival, and both you and I kept talking about the Gap commercials. What we completely forgot about was in 1994, The Mask comes out and is a huge hit with a full swing soundtrack.
Absolutely. I think that's what started
I think that's
now that you mentioned
it. Did that have Cherry Pop and Daddies on it, or did it have Royal Crown Review? I think it had one of those bands.
It had Royal Crown Review, it had Brian Setzer on it. And it had Fishbone on it.
Like, and he was wearing like an actual suit.
Like it is an all swing revival album.
I loved that soundtrack. I like listen to it on CD every day.
It's a great album. Funny. But I was like, I can't believe that throughout that entire episode, we didn't bring up that in 1994, this massive movie had like a huge swing revival to it.
You're totally right, because that it had Brian Setzer, it had Royal Crown, but it didn't have the songs that we associate with those bands as being the big hits. Yeah. What it was just the sort of planting of the seeds that then somebody pumped a little money in to get a Big Bad Voodoo Daddy record recorded, or to assemble that Cherry Pop and Daddy's comp album that was all their swing.
Yeah.
Like that's, there was like an echo 2 years later of The Mask. Yeah. Good call. Yeah. I have not seen The Mask since probably that year. So I forgot about it.
I wonder if it would hold up. Do you think?
So we did it with Horror Movie Night. Every Black Friday, we pick each one of the hosts picks a non-horror movie and lets our fans vote on like a non-horror movie for us to kick the year off with. And I thought, The Mask would be fun. And that actually won. That's why it came to me. We did an episode this past week on it. I would say that it probably, of the first four or five Jim Carrey comedies, ages the best. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Like there isn't any glaring like homophobic or transphobic or awkwardness in them. But it's the one that aged the best. It's also probably the least fun watch. Like, I still... we'll have a blast watching Dumb and Dumber or Ace Ventura, despite all of the
like
2026 issues in it, where like The Mask is just like a fun Dark Horse comics inspired movie. Yeah. You know, like it's just, it's a slightly better The Shadow or The Phantom. Like,
So, like, not to derail back on the rail, but
this is the
example.
Can you turn this episode into like 7 different sidetracks?
That's pretty much what we're doing here.
But it's a great example, right? Because the record labels are responding. Let's say whatever was the cause of that sound. Well, the cause of that soundtrack being swing is the fact that these bands did exist and the vibe of that movie needed that kind of music. Positive reaction to that, if that led to a knee-jerk signing and 2 years later led to the sort of short-lived swing craze, that's kind of emblematic of what we're talking about, that there's a reaction to Nirvana and a feeding frenzy to sign any weird band you can because you never know who's going to be the next Nirvana. And if they're not the next Nirvana, drop them from the label, right? Like, was it Failure dropped from their label? I'm trying to think like other...
I can't. Brains
went in and out of a major label within a couple years, I think.
Yeah, there's a ton of those. I also, you know, like I think that that's something that's another element, right? Like there is probably a very reasonable line that can be drawn between Oh Brother, Where Art Thou being this major selling soundtrack and the Lumineers and Mumford and Sons having huge careers like 5 or 6 years later.
Absolutely. Like, and I don't think that that's a stretch. Yeah. Like I feel like there's a direct, like a causal correlation that people like, are like, oh, I like this. I like Americana. Yeah. Turns out like it's good music.
So I do think that there's an element of that. I know that I had heard, you know, I do the Christian Cringe podcast. I love Christian music. And there was at one point this interview with the head of Tooth and Nail Records, which was like this giant Christian punk and metal record label. And he had an interview with a guy who ran a different Christian punk record label. And their whole back and forth was he was talking about why this guy's record label no longer exists and Tooth and Nail is still around. And one of the big reasons was the type of contract that they signed for their upstream contracts. Mm. And the guy from the failed record, the record label that went under was basically like, when you're signing with like Atlantic Records, their mindset is like, we're going to sign 20 new artists and we're going to hope, like we owned all of the Beatles music or whatever. We're going to hope that this band is as big that they can be close to our next Beatles. And if all 20 of these bands fail, we will be fine because we just have to re-release another compilation of Beatles' greatest hits that is going to be the number one best-selling record of the year, and that'll cover our backs, and then we'll just drop all of these other bands. And like that's kind of the mentality a lot of the time is like, we're going to sign these bands, we're going to give them a chance, and if they wow us, amazing, and if they don't, then we're just going to move on and we're going to do a remaster release of something that we know will sell and try again with another 20 bands and see what happens.
It's like if you're a venture capitalist, angel investor, you just have money.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'll send $10 million to this startup that's super high risk because maybe I'll make $1 billion. And if I don't, whatever, I still have a lot of money.
But for the poor guys who are living in a van and like now
bands.
They finally got this once in a million opportunity that's gone before they even have any chance to do anything with it, like they're just pawns in that record label's hopes for success. You know what I mean? Like it's
also the point, like if you try to do 20 tasks, you're not going to do any of them well.
No.
Right? You're going to get them all done, but they're not going to be the best they could be. Whereas if you just focused on 5 really good, promising artists, you could probably get them there with good mentorship and guidance and producers and putting some money behind marketing. But if you can't do that, it's a real bummer to the musicians. It's not like giving them even a shot.
The drummer of Semisonic has a book out, and I think it's called So You Want to Be a Rock Star. I think that's what it's called. And he talks so much about how often that band was just bumping heads with the record label, where the record label didn't think that Closing Time was a hit. They like put out a different song first, that he's like, these record labels don't necessarily know what the audience wants. They're just guessing. He's like, but we, the band, are the ones that are on the road playing it, seeing the songs that audiences are responding to. And like, we have a better idea of what song we think an audience is going to want to hear. He's like, Dan Wilson, lead singer, was very strong-willed and said, no, if you want this album, you're putting out Closing Time because Closing Time is your hit. Like, you know, find me 20 other guys getting handed a record contract that are willing to stand up and fight that hard against the people giving them the money. Like,
and it takes experience and like grit. And that's something a 18-year-old living in a van might not have. They might just be really eager to get their ticket. Right. So it takes, some grind to be able to stand up against this big machine. And, you know, I think it's important to do that and nurture that. But good mentorship matters in those cases. And you can't mentor 20 bands to success.
But what's interesting about that specific book is that two of the three members of Semisonic, the bassist and Dan Wilson, were in a different band first that was already signed and had kind of gone through the corporate machine unsuccessfully. And their drummer was just this kid who was a fan of that band. So like when they started this new band and he became the drummer, like he talks about in the book that Semisonic played their first show and it was a sold out show because it was all these people who loved this previous band. But he's like, I had never played drums in front of an audience before. And my first show is playing drums in front of a sold out crowd. So a lot of his book is about like imposter syndrome, panic attacks. Like he almost quit that band like eight different times because of feeling like these guys have worked for 10 years for this. And I'm just some idiot that they befriended, that they were like, you should be our drummer that like doesn't deserve to be here already.
Are you talking about Trip Shakespeare or Pleasure?
Trip Shakespeare was the band.
I do not know that. I looked that up and because I knew someone in the Discord was going to yell at us for not knowing it. This all reminds me of our first guest this season. Bree Nguyen was making the point back when everybody, if you haven't listened to that episode, check it out. She basically dropped out of high school, my high school, to go run web marketing for Mariah Carey. And she talked about how the people on top in that era were like the people that had broken Hall & Oates 20 years earlier.
Yeah.
Right. And so not only in our conversation with her, it was very much about how they didn't understand the internet. But to the Semisonic point, they don't understand what's happening at the live show either. Like whoever was in charge of these labels in the mid-90s, maybe their A&R crew was going to shows, but the label execs cut their teeth, you know, with Yacht Rock or with disco, you know, decade and a half earlier, right? So things change quickly, and luckily some artists are able to be hard-nosed enough to, you know, get that single on the radio or whatever.
Mark, I feel bad. I feel like we're definitely going to have to change whatever the name of this sidetrack is, because we didn't actually hit the main topic, but it's just a conversation about how crazy the 90s alternative music landscape was.
What is the main topic? I feel like that is the main topic.
I think the main topic was just, hey, wasn't the music in 1995 and 1996 really weird? That's what I pitched. But I knew that we were not just going to bounce all over 90s rock history at a certain point.
I thought the main topic was Matt Kelly's awesome and we can't wait to talk to him.
Aw, that's Nicole trying to get invited back onto a podcast.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know, I'm in over my head with you guys. Like, I admit it. No, if you want to talk about like the death is a stress model, we can do that. And that's a whole different conversation.
Diagnose this. Here's my weird, shameful confession is that I secretly, now not secretly, now publicly, wish that I was like 5 years older or 5 years younger, because I wish that I had had the opportunity to be predated upon by a record label in the mid-90s. Like, by the time I'm a pretty good musician. I was pretty bad back then, but if I was a few years older, I would have been better. I'm a pretty good musician, and now it's too hard to get noticed, you know? Whereas I can fantasize that were I one of those 20 that were signed, I could have been successful. But then fast forward to when I did come of age, and the record company model had completely collapsed because of Napster. Napster and file sharing and the internet in general. They were not spending on anything. Nobody was getting signed for any of that kind of regular stuff. But then 5 years later, there was GarageBand and computers that you could get a cheap mic to record. You weren't going to have to use the stupid four tracks that my band in high school was using. There was YouTube, MySpace. Obviously, MySpace existed while I was in college and stuff. But it feels like the Xennials fall into this, which I don't know. Matt, are you just too young to be a Xennial?
I think I am either just too young or I'm right at the tail end, because I'm 85. And I think it's like
85. So
yeah, it's like right there.
It's like 78 to 83 or whatever, maybe. And I feel like there's a lot of benefits to our generational cohort, as we have discussed in previous podcasts. superpowers that we get for being in that cohort, but sort of we fell into this weird crack where the record labels hadn't yet figured out they could sell MP3s on iTunes and no longer were operating in the old, let's sell a bunch of $20 albums at Sam Goody model. I still remember teaching a high school class when I was probably 22 years old. So like probably way too young and dumb to be put in charge of 15 and 16 year olds. And this kid had songs on iTunes that he recorded junk, whatever he did on GarageBand or whatever. And he got it through CD Baby or whatever it was at the time, got it distributed. And I remember being just like, damn, I wish I had that access. Now, that kid is now not a famous musician. Like, it wasn't like great, but what's the psychosis of the grass is always greener for me?
Yeah.
No, like, I feel like I wish I was a part of this feeding frenzy. Yeah. Or I wish I was, because by the time I figured it out, I was already like late 20s, early 30s. YouTube was a thing. Like, I missed my chance to be like the next big thing. Like, sorry, that was a long rant. I'm going to edit all this away. And your response is not going to make any sense to the listener.
Perfect.
Nicole.
What else is new? No, I think that like what I'm hearing, and that's such a very therapist-y thing to say, so I apologize. So cringy. What I'm hearing is that you feel like you missed out. Like you feel like you didn't get the opportunities that you were deserved of based on your talent, which is like you're talented for sure. But I also think like there's some hindsight bias in there too. Like when you look back, now you know what it would have taken because you saw how it played out. But at that moment, you didn't have the skill set to find success. You know, you're looking back and you know, okay, that's what it took for those bands to be successful. I could have done that. But at that moment, you didn't have that information, right?
Right.
So I think that you're just, this is a cognitive distortion, Mark.
Yeah.
And it's not too late. You're not old and crusty.
I was just about to say that. I do think, and this goes with podcasting as well as writing and filmmaking and like a million other things, is that I do think that society definitely makes all of us think that there is a finite timeline where if you haven't made it happen by 30 or 40 or 50, like that's just not in the cards for you and you're never you might as well just give it up and you know work the 9-to-5 desk job and call it quits. And I don't subscribe to that. I also think that people need to adjust what they define as success. Like maybe I look to my uncle, right? My uncle during that swing frenzy of the 90s was in a swing band that got signed, and then in the process of them being signed and going to the record label, the label was like, hey, actually the swing thing's dead and you guys we're not putting out the album at all, and like
yikes.
those recordings that he did has never seen the light of day. But his full-time job is still being in a band that is like one of Philly's top like wedding and party bands, and that is his full income, and he gets to spend all of his time with his wife and kids and like make music his full-time job. And I'm like, that's amazing. Like that's all that you could ever ask for.
Sorry, very important.
Very important.
What do they call it?
They call that a GB band.
No, but do they? Is he in a GB band or is that only in Boston? What kind of band, if you asked your uncle, what kind of music do you play? What would he say?
I mean, he just considers himself like a bar band that gets paid very well to play weddings.
Yeah. I bet they don't. I think GB band is like a New England.
It's just a Boston
listeners,
thing?
Write in. We need Connecticutians. Is that what they're called? People
that
from Connecticut.
Can't be right. Yeah.
Is
no
that
way.
Still, do they still call it GB? Do they call it GB in New York? Do they call it GB in Maine? Probably. But what about in Montreal? Like, how far does this term go? General business is the term used in Boston. This comes up maybe every other episode of our podcast.
Only because I love, I never knew that term before we started podcasting together. And now I try to use it everywhere
that's what
I can.
Well,
I'm so glad that I was able to give an excuse.
I was like, he said it.
The drinking game would be every time Nicole or I mention GB, take a shot. Well, every time Nicole is proud of herself for knowing what it means, everybody has to take a shot.
I even like the other day, my friends were like, oh, we're in this cover band. We just play bars and stuff. I was like, oh yeah, GB band. General business.
And they knew that you were cool.
No, they had
knew.
No clue what I was talking about.
Oh,
it
they
actually
didn't know?
Fell
yeah.
as flat then as it did just now.
Did you tell them that you have perfect pitch recognition?
I did, yeah. And they were like, prove it. Oh, and I was like,
here
okay.
We go again. Play any note and I'll tell you what it is.
I'll just tell you what note it is. I'm like a savant.
You were saying something like meaningful. You brought up your...
I know, I was, right?
Like, or no, Matt was.
Oh, cool. Sorry. Yeah, great. Perfect.
Look, the thing is, like, by all accounts, I have won the lottery as a musician.
Yes.
I am a professional musician. I am a literal college professor. How much more elitist and lucky could I be, right? Now, I didn't have what I maybe wanted when I was 20 years old or whatever, but that's the thing. It's like, that thing shouldn't even be plan A. That thing is like plan alpha or whatever, right? That isn't even a realistic plan. That's just a maybe I'll just get lucky, right? Now, obviously, I didn't do the thing where I joined a band when I was 20 and toured the world and just that was my whole life. I went to school and all this other stuff. But no, I don't at all view myself. Thanks for the therapy to both of you. I don't at all view my life as a failure. It's more just like this window of industry collapsing, right? Like, it's, you know, for me, it was graduating from grad school, but people your age graduated from college right as the economy tanked. That was a little bit like, congratulations, you're a trained musician now. The record industry doesn't exist anymore. Like, that's kind of what it felt like that a little bit to me, which I can whine about even though I've won.
To me, you're living my dream, Mark. Like my goal is not to be the world's biggest podcaster on the planet, even though I certainly try. But it's like, if I don't have to check my bank account every time that I go to get groceries to make sure that there's enough money in there, and that's coming from podcasting, whether it's teaching a course on podcasting or from ad money, like, that is just as great. As long as what I do, I'm satisfied by, and it's tied to this field that I love so very, very much, like, that is the win. So yeah, like, I don't know. We've taken a weird route. This is the weirdest side. I listen to every sidetracking. This is the weirdest sidetracking. I'm sorry.
Weirder than the one about psychics.
I just need to nod to positive psychology for a quick second if you'll like indulge me on that. But there's this tenet in positive psychology that says that if we always put success on the other side of a goalpost, we'll never actually find happiness. Success will never bring us happiness because we'll just keep changing the goal. So if you fall into this trap, like, I'll be happy when.
Yeah.
Like, I'll be happy when I'm a successful musician, when I drop my first album, or when I get married, buy a house, have kids, like, when I get this job I've always wanted, right? When you do that, you never actually allow yourself happiness, because as soon as you hit that mark, you just change where the goal is and move it down the field further, right? So positive psychology teaches us to be happy now, and success will come because your happiness will invite opportunities for success in your life. And it won't be, one doesn't lead to the other, one's because of the other. We're doing that a lot here. Like, when I was a kid, I thought I'd be happy when a label signed me. But now we're learning as adults that we don't get to just plateau. We have to and get to keep changing and growing over time. And that's awesome. So to look back and say, like, this is the path not taken, it doesn't serve us at all, right? Because you are where you are right now, and it's a pretty good spot for all of us. Like, we have a nice little life.
Case in point, Matt, I can assume you do not have a degree in podcasting.
No.
It's that you, this is a way you can leverage the skills you have, right?
Yeah.
To be, you know, fulfilled and make rent or whatever. And that's, like, what I'm... A lot of times my students, you know, I teach in a field where the degree means nothing, you know, like, literally, I was trying to go through some process, not to get too department chair on y'all, but I was creating a new certificate program in music technology. Someone in the grants office was like, "Whoa, okay, we can try to get grants. Can you tell me which jobs your students will be entitled to when they finish this program?" And I'm like, I have a doctorate and I'm not entitled to nothing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's all about the skills you get. And so I tell my students, and I wish somebody had said it this way when I was a student, it would have resonated with me. Just like, you've won if you are using the skills you learn here.
Yeah.
Like, if you're in this industry, even if you're not, you're training to be a professional guitar player. Maybe you're not doing that. Maybe you're teaching. Maybe you're working at an instrument shop doing repairs. Maybe you're like an event coordinator or whatever. If you're in this industry and using the skills and you get a 9-to-5 or some kind of a paycheck for it, that's the holy grail. But, like, that's an attainable holy grail, as opposed to, I'm going to go be a you know, the first chair violin of the Boston Symphony or whatever, or a rock star, right?
I always joke around that, like, I have a liberal arts degree, which I feel like is the punchline to worthless degrees in college in general. But, like, I look at it as I got a degree where I could take whatever classes I felt necessary, and I used them to take every music history class, to take every film history class, to take business classes, to take marketing classes, to take, like, I have utilized skills that I learned in every single class that I took over. Honestly, the only skills I haven't used in my life from college are, like, the prereqs of math and,
like, gen eds.
Yeah, like the
right.
gen eds. Like,
and I'm going to advocate, I'm appalled. Liberal arts degrees are not useless.
They're not.
So valid for the reasons you're describing,
yeah.
because you get to take classes for the first time in your life, learn about things that you're genuinely interested in, genuinely passionate about. And when I work with students, I always say, like, you don't know what you want to be when you grow up. Good.
Yeah.
Just take classes that you're interested in, because then you'll have skills that serve those interests. And then you can get a job with those skills in something you're interested in. And that seems like exactly what you did,
100%.
Matt. So
I almost had a minor in American studies because I took so
nice.
Many pop culture based classes over 4
They're
years.
They're like, we'll just give them this.
They literally said, if you stayed one more semester and just took one more American studies class, you would have a minor in American studies. And I was
Sounds like you had a great academic advisor. Love that.
And I was like, yeah, I'm not coming back to take one class. I'm going to go ahead and graduate.
No thanks.
Because we all know that a minor confers upon you so many rights and privileges.
Exactly.
And it would
also
be like at least maybe like 10 grand, maybe.
Right. Well, it depends. I mean, the liberal arts degree at a state university, regional public university, does have a value proposition difference to the liberal arts degree that costs just 60 grand a year or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it does. Because it's the clout of the school that gets you the job or gets you the networking.
No, but I'm saying even just like you could spend 4 years learning. And if you're $200,000 in debt, that learning is right. maybe not enough. Whereas if you're saying you're right, you'll get a better job maybe if you go to Harvard or whatever. But on the other hand, you're paying per word you're reading in those exploratory classes a higher
yeah.
fee, right?
Absolutely. And when I taught at community college versus a private university, there'd be days that I'd go to that community college and teach Psych 101. And then get on the train and go to the private university and teach Psych 101. Same exact lectures, same yeah. exact tests, same exact textbook, same exact teacher. The only thing that was different is at one school, I had to like bring my own markers with me. And the other school, there's markers everywhere you look. And the classrooms are a little bit nicer. So
all right.
That's all I got.
Yeah, I think
we're ranting.
We hit the logical end of the topic.
I think somehow we got to like Nicole ranting about higher ed and how like liberal arts matters.
This
like, don't kill liberal arts.
I think I'm going to walk away and just hope that this is someone's favorite episode and not everyone's least favorite episode.
Oh my God. We have been threatening it so long, Nicole. We're going to have a full on episode that's a rant on higher ed one day, right? Because there's so much to talk about that we just will drop a bomb. Like, I'll just in the middle of an episode be like, music theory is white supremacist. Okay, moving on. And we don't talk about it. Like, higher ed
like,
is a
why
racket.
Why are we even teaching Maslow anymore? He's an asshole.
Right. We'll just leave it there and leave. Yeah. And one of these days we're going to have to actually unpack it once we feel job security.
Yeah.
Our day jobs.
That's why I'm like, this is just propaganda for liberal arts degrees at this point for my own job security. But I do think, you know, what you talk about, like passion in your jobs, like it's so nice to hear someone else in a different field say, like, I just want to do something that I wake up every day and I'm inspired to do it. And I find passion in it. It doesn't feel like work. And I just want to do this and make enough money to like buy groceries. And I feel the same way about teaching. Like, I'm just so happy I get to go to work at a job I love every day with students I genuinely care about, teaching content that I'm really passionate about. And I don't have to worry about like if I'm going to be able to buy groceries or not. And that's a real blessing that not a lot of people get. So I think Mark and I stop ourselves from ranting about higher ed because I think we share that feeling and that passion that we don't want to one bite the hand that feeds us, but also like we love it and it's flawed.
Yeah.
And I think it's
I spent New Year's Eve for at least 3 hours of my New Year's Eve on my computer building a to-do list and goals board for every podcast that I do. You don't do that on New Year's Eve unless you are so passionate about what you're doing that that's right. what you'd rather be doing yeah. than anything else on your New right. Year's Eve. Like, I was like, oh, these are the goals for this podcast. These are the goals for this podcast. And then, like, sending emails to my co-hosts at, like, 10 at night when they're like, what are you doing? Why are you emailing right. me? A breakdown of goals for One Hit Thunder this year.
Like, I'm sure your partner was thrilled to spend her New Year's Eve doing that, though. I'll say that.
We were going to host a party. Then every Ugh. Guest that was supposed to come had the flu. And we were like, let's just watch movies. And we were yes. in our pajamas at noon.
Well, that works.
And yeah. we watched every 2025 release we hadn't gotten a chance to watch. And then watched the Stranger Things finale. And then went to bed before the oh, ball wow. dropped. It was lovely.
I love that. Beautiful. I share that. And I'll add, like, yesterday, it was like a weekend night. And we went out to dinner and it was really nice. And then we came home and I just, like, sat and, like, dove into my lifespan development syllabus and wrote this whole unit on, like, end of life care and the afterlife and cultural views on, like, spirituality and death. And my husband was like, what are you doing? I was like, I'm writing my syllabus, I'm pumped about it.
Yeah.
And if you're doing that on a Saturday night, Friday night, you're doing pretty good, I think.
Yeah, you're living your life.
If anybody can't tell from the theme of this episode being the mid-90s, we are old.
Yeah.
We are quite old.
I got very excited to buy a new toaster with my Christmas money.
Nice, yeah.
Have you heard about air fryers yet?
Oh, I've got an air fryer too, but I was done with having only two toaster slots. I need it four. So that I could make
all the toast.
I could make cinnamon bread for my girlfriend and me simultaneously instead of one at a time, where one of us was eating toast while the other one was still waiting for toast.
Now that's you can self-actualize.
We don't need
morning.
To live like this, you know?
All right. Okay. Matt, this has been really fun and we are gonna just keep going. We'll
audience.
Talk about breakfast.
I'm so sorry.
I love it. Come hang out with us every day. You're the best.
The network we're part of, the Lorehounds, have entire episodes about breakfast. So there are hot takes in the community. Lorehounds people, write in. What do you think? How does he need to go to an 8-slot toaster? Okay, Matt, we've already talked a bit about the podcasts people can find you on. Do you want to tell us what's going? So this is first week of January. What's going on a few of your shows? If people, because this community, we've got our listeners, of course, are music and psych fans, but there's the Lorehounds have book readers, movie watchers, TV shows. So give us a sampling of the kinds of episodes on your shows that if people want to check what you're doing out, what they should listen to.
Okay. I'm going to do the way I always do, which is just walk my way through the calendar. So Monday, every Monday night is Christmas 365. I think I've done a pretty good long pitch on that at the start of that. So you're either sold on that or not. On Tuesdays is YAOK, which is a bi-weekly podcast. It's about young adult novels. It's hosted by my friend Eric J. Brown, who is a YA author who wrote the book All That's Left in the World. He's a USA Weekly bestseller. And his co-host is Alyssa Lube from the Netflix reality show The Circle. The two of them sit down with different up-and-coming young adult authors and talk about their new books and what like drew them to this specific genre of fiction. Wednesdays is One Hit Thunder, which is the biggest show that I do. It's hosted by myself and Chris Fafios of the band Punchline. We talk about One Hit Wonders. We deep dive. Both of you have been on it. So if you like Nevermind the Music, that is a beautiful starting point. Thursdays is Horror Movie Night. Every week, me and my two friends break down the strangest, most delightful horror films of the 80s, 90s, and beyond. Fridays is Weird Algorithm, which is a weekly Weird Al podcast hosted by myself and Matt Milligan of the band Wheatus, where we are just going through Al's entire catalog song by song, trying to figure out what is the best Weird Al song. That show is probably going to end in 2026 because we're almost done his catalog. Saturday, I get a break from podcasting. Oh. That's just Patreon.
Oh, and I've
bonus
been on
content.
That too, by the way.
Yes, Mark has been on that a couple times.
He's quick to remind us.
Saturdays, I get a break and it's just podcast Patreon content for some of my shows on Saturdays. And then Sunday is the Christian Cringe podcast, the newest of all the shows, where myself and Katie Hampton go through 80s and 90s Christian media, whether it's VeggieTales episodes, Christian punk albums, horror films made from Christian companies, and just cringe through it, trying to see, hey, is some of this good? Is some of this, or is it all bad? And there's some really good stuff in there. Five Iron Frenzy comes to mind as a truly great, quote-unquote, Christian artist that still has aged amazingly all these years later. Case in point, if you're like, hey, I like ska music, but I don't want to listen to a Christian ska band, their very first song on their very first album was about how fucked up Manifest Destiny was in a very, like, F you to the church kind of way. Like, they have been a political punk band that just happens to also be Christians from day one.
Cool.
It's pretty, they actually just released a shirt. Their band formed in 1997. They released a shirt that says fighting white nationalism since 1997.
Nice. So
they, yeah, they're very, they're like the Rage Against the Machines of Christian ska bands.
Wow. You know what? When we started this episode, that's not a phrase I expected to hear really ever in my life.
But yeah, that's basically everything. So if you haven't been annoyed at me over the last hour, just road running us off the road over and over again, topic wise, check out any of those shows. And I run the Geekscape Network. So subscribe to our YouTube channel, Geekscape TV, where I do video essays and live streams and stuff.
Wow. You're awesome, Matt.
Oh, thank you. I think you guys are awesome too.
Nevermind the Music is hosted by Nicole Batcher and me, Mark Poppany. I also produce. Please leave us a rating and a review, and don't forget to follow. We're Never Music Pod on social media, and you can also send us an email at nevermusicpod@gmail.com. Nevermind the Music is part of the Lorehounds Network. Join the conversation by going to thelorehounds.com and hop on our Discord server. Thanks for listening.